Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 91, where Tom Fritjof and our special guest Anna are discussing the works of Mary Parker Follett from the compilation Dynamic Administration, first published in 1942. In part two, we will continue the discussion of the first five chapters of the book and consider the resurgence of interest in Follett and the contemporary implications of her work. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
I think the beauty of the work that we see now from Follett, but also the challenge, and that I think still makes it challenging for us to really apply these ideas in practice, is there are profound philosophical ideas that she brings to bear on organizing, on management, on business administration, that are so profound but also so different from a lot of the other foundational work on organizing, that in a lot of the ways that especially she highlights the relationships, the processual, the experiential nature of management, makes it really difficult to apply these ideas to kind of like current organizations, because current organizations are really founded on other perspectives. And I'm really curious to hear from both of you as well. What do you see as like kind of like, what are the takeaways that we can take from Follett, who was writing 100 years ago, to bear on organizations now, but also to bear on research nowadays? Because I think it is really, I feel quite challenged in trying to apply these ideas in both in practice and as well as in research.
I'll start with a philosophical question. Considering the challenges that organizations face nowadays, has the nature of what Follett presented as the problems changed, or is it their character? So, you know, and the difference between nature and character, what I'm referring to is that the fundamental way that the problem manifests, as opposed to the problem manifesting differently or for a particular setting or situation. I would tend to take the view that the nature is unchanged, but the characters have changed. And what we hear is in popular media or whatever is that the problems that we're facing now are in some way novel or new or whatever. It may be new because of the ways and means we have to communicate, the ways and the ends to which organizations exist. But the fundamental problem of, like, for example, the challenges of power over and the fighting attitude, I think are prevalent today, but the character of that is different because we have different tools, different ideas about what power over may mean. But the idea that power over is a problem has transcended from the particular settings that Follett was interested in and are manifesting now. So I think there's a lot that we can draw forward, but almost taking a pragmatic approach, we have to adapt. We have to think about how we would come to understand what the character of the present day situations mean in order to make the best sense of how we apply Follett to nowadays.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think what she's presenting is some very basic human problems, in a sense, which are as prevalent today as they were then, but they manifest themselves differently. And maybe even the paradox is that she's been proven right in many of her, you know, she's often called like the prophet of management, and she was so ahead of her time. And we hear this all the time. And we can all agree that she, you know, her view of human nature, for example, you know, and believing in the judgment of the worker and so on, we completely buy into that, as opposed to, say, Taylor, who's the Taylor system she's all the time contrasting against, who believe that, you know, the workers were different from the managers, and the manager, everybody knows this, it was the optimal system, and workers as cogs in a machine. We don't buy that. So, but at the same time, the idea that he presented, which was system first, man second, as opposed to man first and then system second, is perhaps even more prevalent today, because we are in a time where we are dependent on systems, of course, spurred by the digital development and IT and so on, but for many other things as well. There's a lot of talk about systems, and systems tend to be fixed, no matter how much we like to talk about dynamic systems. And I think many of us feel that we are, as people, we are subordinate to systems. So there's sort of a paradox here, that we buy into her philosophy, we buy into her values, and yet at the same time, we feel more caught in systems than ever, and in micromanaging and these kind of rigid directives and so on.
I think that's actually the interesting part as well about the Follett, because Follett, amongst other things, is also seen as one of the first systems theorists or systems thinkers in management. But it doesn't always come to the fore as clearly, but this idea of the whole situation, I think in a nutshell, it really comes down to this, that there's a wholeness to the situation, and that the situation is not kind of limited in time and space, but it really, like, whatever kind of like influences the situation at the moment, and whatever links you see, it's all in that sense part of the situation. But I think it's also a profoundly different perspective on systems that we see. So as an example, I'm also in design, I work on systemic design, which previously you also had systems design, and it's really very fundamentally different perspectives on systems. So where in the systems design, you assume that you can design the system. And in systemic design, it's much more about that, but you already are in a system, and you need to acknowledge that there is a system around you, and that the system will do things that you did not expect, and you need to kind of deal with. And I think the same also applies to organizations. The assumption that oh, we can just create the organization, we can just design the organization, and then others will implement it. It's maybe one approach to deal with this, but I think a much more interesting approach is kind of like exploring the organization as this continuous process, and trying to find ways to deal with the wholeness of the situation, to deal with the wholeness of problems that cannot be just reduced to certain departments and certain functions, but really have to be seen as much more as from this integrative perspective. But it is really, really difficult, because it really requires different ways for people to relate to each other. And that's also why she highlights so much this need for methods. And these methods are not static, they are continuously evolving, but we need to develop the methods to allow for the cooperation, for the coordination to emerge. And it's this highly dynamic approach to administration that I find so interesting, but also so challenging.
Now, I want to throw this out, because if there was an argument to say that the nature of the situation has changed as opposed to its character, let's unpack the idea of systems and how we're using it. Because on the one hand, there is the use of the term to describe technologies and processes and systems. And then there's what you're describing, Fritjof, which is sort of like a more holistic everything about the organization and how we design it. Now, let me take the former one and talk about systems, processes, mechanisms. And I'm relating this back to, I want to say it was episode 68 that we did on the documentary American Factory, in which you had it was presenting a conflict between the Chinese ownership of a former American factory that the Chinese were reopening and bringing in American workers. Notwithstanding everything that we talked about with Follett so far, the way that this documentary ended is that ultimately a lot of the workers were replaced by robots. And in this particular instance now, we have a very, very interesting dynamic in terms of, you know, what is the worker, right? Because here to this point, we've been talking about workers as humans, and we're trying to change the power over relationship between managers and workers such that there's participation. However, in this particular case, and this is not isolated to this factory, obviously, we have a situation where basically the manager has now asserted power over a form of worker, non-human, with no possibility or no means by which to participate in the process or in any of the, there is no negotiation, there's no anything. So now, in a sense, by redefining how the work is being done, are we having to take another look at what we're trying to accomplish or think about implementing and what Follett is proposing?
I think that what Follett is essentially proposing is a shift in perspective by talking about this, you know, her processual relational view. And this is why it's so hard, because it's an attitude that she talks about all the time. It's a mental shift. And that is the most important thing to her. And then the structures and so on are second. So I think the sort of automation thinking, the idea that we replace people with robots, is basically the same 100 years ago to now. We have much more sophisticated technique and so on, much more sophisticated systems, etc. But the basic perspective is the same. It's the efficiency and the optimal system, even though our systems are much more sophisticated. I think her basic point is really the change in attitude. And the core of that is trust in people and let the power and the development and the organizing emerge locally. And then you build it up. And this requires, this is what she talks about all the time with integration and the attitude of responsibility, of experimentation, of, you know, being conscious about your own reactions or so on, and even the scientific attitude. This is what it requires from everyone, manager and worker. But it also requires a different way of looking at the organization and a different language. And I think what strikes me is we have the same issues with language today, as she pointed out. So let me give you an example. When she talks about power and authority and so on, she criticizes the use of language. It says this is a real issue here when she talks about the idea that power can be distributed and, or that authority must be distributed from its source, filters down through delegation to all parts of business organization. And then she asks, power must be distributed from its source? Well, very well, but what is the source? You know, it's this view of power as an entity that she criticizes. And we can all agree with that, but we still have that in the way we talk about power and in the literature. So I'm currently looking into, as I mentioned, self-managing organizations, new ways of working, which to me is very much about this, applying Follettian principles, although these companies don't know that this is what they're doing necessarily. But there are a lot of companies out there doing really interesting experiments with organizing differently, which all depart from this idea that the employees are adult. You know, we don't have to give them directives. We give them the authority to figure out in their own group how they work, and they take responsibility. And then they work through methods of integration. But the literature about this still talks about these kinds of organization as radical decentralization, radical distribution and distribution of power, etc., in exactly those same words that Follett critiques. So in a way, we're still there about, we cannot get out of that thinking of the organization in those traditional terms. And that's one, I think, one of the main challenges.
Now, the question I have, though, is that to what extent does membership in the organization become a source or a barrier to such integration? And I can think in terms of not just instances where there is a situation where the organization has to downsize or right size, But even in terms of expansion, even in other things where basically the organization is going to change in size in such a way that, or that the organization itself, organization's own structure prevents or becomes a barrier simply because the members, I'm in the public sector, so there's a lot of heavy structure associated with how we define positions, how we define jobs, what managers do, probably more so than in a private sector or perhaps just differently. But the fact is that the definition of one standing in the organization by rank, by stature, by what have you, would seem to be an inherent barrier that has to be overcome. And it gets even more difficult when we say that, well, not my job, or, you know, when those sorts of things come up, where there are some structural barriers against being able to have the free exchange of ideas or the integration that we're talking about.
Now, I think that that is exactly the attitude that Follett is talking about. It's a question of what values we hold on to. It comes back to the worldview that she is promoting. So it's a question of, you know, some would call it culture. What is it? But these things, the technical side and the human side, as we said, they go together. So what is it that we have been promoting? Like Follett also points out, a barrier to integration is our habits of kind of enjoying domination, right? Because we're in culture to do that. It's part of the way things have always worked. And it's very tricky, you know, it's tough to take that away from people, to take that little status thing away, which is not necessarily something we really care about, like having the biggest corner office or whatever it is. But when it's taken away, you know, it becomes painful. So I think it's more a question of attitude, to use Follett's term, than it is of structures, unless you call that a structure. So that's, I guess, a semantic point. But again, we come back to the idea of language.
But I guess in a way, the thing with structure is it's kind of like, for at least maybe that's my wrong interpretation. It's kind of like the power over versus power with. If we give structure that power, then it has that power. But and like if no one gives the structure the power, it doesn't have that power. But I think maybe one thing to realize also is like this assumption of control versus the pragmatist approach of inquiry, where control is kind of like having pre-established by someone who does the planning or the managing what the standard is that we control for. Versus really having it emerge out of the inquiry of the employees on the work floor together with the managers, etc. That's quite a different approach. And I think one of the challenges we keep facing is that a lot of the complexity that we face is kind of like introduced by ourselves, by having systems designed within systems, across systems, within systems, and then every time defining system boundaries, even though in a really relational perspective, in a really systemic perspective, there are no boundaries to the system, because like where could the boundaries come from? So it's all these simplifications that we bring in, but somehow we don't, you know, kind of like also to think in Dewey's terms on learning and pragmatism, because we don't feed back with the experience that we have into what we did before, we don't realize, well, part of what we run into now is the system that we designed before. And part of the unintended consequences are that we back then didn't consider something that we should know now. But we are not really able to kind of like close the feedback loop and adjust our actions from back then to really, yeah, think and act more systemically, which I think it's a really big problem.
Yeah, and I can kind of think about, you know, here we are on the downside of the pandemic and how much, you know, what we're discussing has been even exacerbated when we all moved to remote, because even in situations where perhaps we were working a little bit more integratively, or that there was greater opportunities for integration, and then being put into a remote distributed environment that we weren't accustomed to, the reaction, you know, we had an episode on workplace isolation, episode 66, which was a fascinating study. What I'm kind of getting at is another question as to, you know, again, getting to the character of the problems that we face nowadays. Since it is apparent that now we're going to be accepting more remote or distributed functions and whatever, it would seem natural for us to be able to say that, yeah, this makes wonderful sense that we would want to have integration reinforced because we don't want our distributed workers to feel isolated, or we don't want certain segments who are close to the brick and mortar headquarters facility or whatever to suddenly become so dominant in the way that the workplace orients. But do we know enough about how to counter that? Is this an area of research, or do we kind of know and we just need to do it? What do you think?
Good, very good question, I think. I think it's a very open question. And as usual, there are probably, you know, pros and cons. But I think for integration, it's about concrete action and doing things together. It's about the human contact, so to speak. And of course, this can be done online, but it's different. So it has the positive aspects, of course, that we can sit here in different locations and have this conversation. But it also makes the conversation much more difficult, of course.
Yeah, it's different than, say, having the water cooler conversation or the whiteboard conversation and that sort of thing. Because even though we're all having a conversation here, we do our recordings over Zoom, obviously, with everybody distributed around the world. And there's a structure that's kind of embedded in it that, you know, we cope with it okay, but it's still, you're right, it's very, very different than this. You don't have the same level of spontaneity. You don't have the same level of ownership. You know, ownership is a big part of this, and it's easier when you're together physically in front of a whiteboard to take ownership on what goes onto the whiteboard, as opposed to what we're doing, which is just, you know, talking to a image of each other from a distance.
Yeah, I'm sure this will have a big impact going forward. So that's certainly an area for future research. And I am sure that that will continue. And it would be very interesting to see, you know, somebody taking more of this relational approach, looking at, you know, this kind of situations in digital contexts.
This might be a bit of a jump, but I, you know, next to reading Follett, if you read a bit more about her life as a person, basically going to Harvard when women were not allowed to go to Harvard, so she had to go to a school next to Harvard where the Harvard professors still went to teach, but she couldn't go to Harvard, and then getting her degree and then consciously foregoing academia, a route that would have been open to her, and instead deciding to go into practice and do her work, you know, in the community centers that she started, but also a lot of her work on unions. I think to me, Follett is also really an inspiration what scholarship could mean and could be, and maybe she was maybe not as much of the intellectual, public intellectual as Dewey was, but I think, so to say, for management, at least back then, she was quite well known. And I think I really like this way of approaching theory and practice not as separates, but really kind of like seeing the connections of both. And I still feel that there's a lot more that could be taken from Follett than we have done yet, because a lot of the profound insights are maybe hidden in more plain language, which makes people discount their profoundness. But I'm curious, like, what do you think about this kind of different approach to academia, different approach to combining the public intellectual, the scholar, but also just the practitioner? I'm curious, what's your perspective?
One of the things that I see in her writing here as applied to academia is how much, like, if she were writing as an academic or on behalf of the field of academia, I'm sure that something resembling the free exchange of ideas would flow. And one of the things that I've been thinking about significantly about lately has been the various barriers to free exchange of ideas that we have instituted in academia, which ostensibly was put there to try to encourage free exchange of ideas, which I think is interesting. You know, we've in several episodes we've gotten onto the discussion of peer review and some of the other structures. But I want to talk about there's one particular book, and it's been used a lot, where the scholarly conversation is the metaphor used, for example, and the idea that when you publish, you're participating in a scholarly conversation with others. I always struggled with that particular metaphor, because when I think of a conversation, I think of free exchange of ideas, which means physically throw your ideas up on something like a whiteboard or a, you know, whatever it is. And somewhere from there, the better ideas flow, and those ideas can be put into practice in some way. And I see that as an example of power with kind of thinking. But because of the need for science to be internally consistent, for there to be a way of differentiating what is valid versus what is not or should not be considered valid, and those sorts of things, we do put together rules, procedures, protocols, structures in order to provide us with an ability to do that while also keeping it depersonalized. But then that takes up so much time, so much space, so much energy. And, you go to a conference, everything is structured. There's you almost have to impose opportunities for just plain old-fashioned conversation, open, free exchange of ideas. It has to be added. It's not an inherent part of the process. So then the question becomes, how do we rebuild or institute the free exchange of ideas back into it without undoing or getting rid of or denigrating, the purposes behind the structures we have in place, because they do serve still a valid purpose. But it's it kind of gets to also the, a complaint that sometimes we have is that, it really would be nice if we had more writings that are in the style of Follett, which are plain speak, practical, or whatever, and not have to depend so much on this level of interpretation we have to do with a academic journal article, which is, can be accurately or renders a study accurately, but can be very difficult to put into practice for a layperson.
I think this is a really, really important point. I think, well, both of your points, actually, I guess they are two sides of the, or different sides of the same coin. I think what you're describing, Tom, that we are putting up all of these more and more and more regulations to kind of ensure our freedoms, in a sense, is a little bit what I was alluding to in the beginning, with saying we believe in Follett's principles, but we're kind of doing it the other way around. So we believe on the sort of judgment and people's ability to take responsibility, but we keep regulating. So, and those systems that we put in place, or structures that we put in place, they embed this non-belief in the human being. So there's a certain paradox there, because we seem to have gone too far in many ways of regulating what was originally a good thing, our rights. So the solution to that is, well, I won't dare go into that. That's a very big question. But I think at least what Follett illustrates is perhaps her own idea of integration in herself as a person, this curiosity that she had. And she studied also so many disciplines. It was history, it was political science, political economy, philosophy, scientific methods, psychology, ethics, literature, and probably lots more. She went into so many different areas. She was teaching in a girls' school. She was working at a law firm before she engaged in social work. She was on lots of committees and so on. And she was part of many different intellectual milieus. She went to the UK to study as well, and so on. So this kind of diversity that she embraced and she sought with a curious and open mind, really searching out people from different walks of life, and also at the same time being free, perhaps not of her choice, because as a woman, she wasn't allowed to join academia. But that really allowed her to come up with something very novel and creative. It's very much her own style. So in this sense, she's an illustration herself of her philosophy and what that can do.
And I think maybe that's also one of the things that makes her so different, is that in a way it's almost like it's like a philosophical approach to management or business administration, in the sense of taking these deep philosophical ideas, say about conflict, say about power, because I feel that that's what they are, but apply them not in the, so to say, in the Western traditions of philosophy, but more in almost Eastern ways of philosophy, in the sense of like, what kind of practical insights can we gain from this? So what kind of practical purpose can we gain from these kind of perspectives? When I was just listening to you, Tom, I was thinking like a lot of these aspects of academia that you talk about, like from a pragmatist perspective, it just looks really different. Say the issue of validity, pragmatic validity is fundamentally different. And it fundamentally would reconnect research again to practice, because unless it shows to be valid in practice, it's not valid. It cannot be just theoretically valid. It has to be valid in practice. And I think also what bothers me, for example, with the scholarly conversation, I think that maybe we should have less scholarly conversation and more just conversation between scholars and practitioners, and not have these differences reinforced, because I feel all too often followed by being so relatively plain spoken, even though her insights are so profound, it makes her work accessible. But I think also others that don't really understand the profound aspect of it, they will discount it. And I feel that a lot of research tries to create abstraction, tries to create the kind of like sophistication by using a lot of jargon to not really actually have similar ideas of similar value. And that's kind of like, I hope there's a way forward where we can be more plain spoken, trying to say more profound things by being less eager to appear to say smart things by being abstract, but really trying to bring it down back to practice. But I think it's very, very hard. And I think it really requires also of us as scholars to kind of like relearn a lot of the habits that a lot of us actually have learned, like in the bachelor and the master, where we were quite unreflective, where we just accepted whatever was taught to us, how interviews work, how science works, etc. And pragmatism would really require us to rethink a lot of these aspects. And I hope that we find ways to kind of like bring these ideas more to practice.
Right. Now, I would, I certainly don't want to paint as any sort of an either or situation, though. I do recognize we can't avoid the fact that there is going to always be a need for, you know, the kind of inquiry that doesn't immediately translate to practice, but it can't be an end to itself, I think, is kind of the way that I would put it, is that there has to be, you know, ways of bridging to it. And I think that it is a fundamental. I like the fact that you brought in the West versus Eastern philosophy. I didn't think of that before, and I kind of see where you're going with that. It's very, I'll have to think about that some more. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, I think that's it's a good the Eastern philosophy metaphor. It's also a good comparison, because that is much more about the holistic, the relational, and so on. But I think it's also good to bring that in to understand how big the shift is in terms of how we have to unlearn our habits, how we have to learn to think in a different way, what that kind of attitude might mean. I think it's almost that it's such a fundamental shift from how we are trained, how we're used to think. And that is also something that Follett brings up in a different book, The New State, where she has an appendix on education. And she points out that for us to become also competent citizens, you know, the same principles apply. We have to take this from experimental attitude, etc. This is something that needs to start at school when children are small, because it's such basic skills and principles that have to do with our basic attitude. So it certainly is a challenge for all of us.
Yeah, and even in the readings, these four chapters, she makes mention of, you know, she's focused heavily on business administration, but she also brings in politics and affairs of the state, and alludes to how, yeah, these same kind of thinking could apply to political discourse or relationships between the citizenry and the government. The chapters were focused on one particular domain of interest, business administration, but no question, there's a lot wider application for this.
Should we just do the rounds, or else I would just say, maybe Anna, if you want a riff of that, I trust you'll find something nice.
Sorry, I don't know if this is at all a good ending to this conversation at all. But I think when we were talking about more like how do we do research, but how do we get there? I think just to keep it simple in a sense is always a good advice from a pragmatist perspective. And so I've noticed that Follett throughout the book, throughout these chapters, she often writes, you know, this is a test of, right? So, for example, one test of your business organization is not how many conflicts you have, for conflicts are the essence of life, but what are your conflicts and how do you deal with them, right? So she does a number of these throughout the tests. So one test of business administration should be, is the organization such that both employers and employees or co-managers, co-directors are stimulated to a reciprocal activity, which will give more than a mere adjustment, more than an equilibrium, that is to give an integration. So maybe that's simply the way to go about it, to go through our tests on these basic principles. And then we all have to work out how we do it from our respective situations.
I'll put in my final takeaway, and I want to go back to a point that we touched on in part one about the role of the administrator, and it's very, very straightforward for us who are reading Follett and understanding it to recognize what, taking the man in the mirror approach, to take a look at how are we approaching things as an individual? Are there things that are causing us to take a fighting stance or a defensive stance in circumstances or situations or whatever that perhaps do not require it, or could another way can be found to think about power with as opposed to power over. And at some point, we have to better understand what it is that causes us to distrust. Is it that we're not seeing the benevolence of the other party? Do we think that they're out to get us? Or do we think that they are in it for themselves? Or, what is the source of that sort of a barrier? If we don't have administration or we don't have leadership that walks the walk and talks the talk in the same way, it has to start from somewhere. And I know that we like to think and we want to encourage each of us to think about ourselves. But I do think it's important that the administrators take a lead, whoever that is, to take a lead and to understand and to see how this can be done in such a way that, is instead of being part of the problem, become the source of the solution. It certainly helps if we think of them as being distinct from management, as we said before. It takes a very fundamentally different approach to what it means to be running an organization. So that's my takeaway. I think I'll stop there.
So what I take away from today's episode is in that sense something similar, that kind of when I first heard the episode, episode 5 on the giving of orders and the wholeness of the situation, that was one of the reasons why I kind of started with pragmatism. I had come across the writings of Dewey, but really that episode kind of showed me hey, there's really a radically different way of engaging with organizing. And today's episode just deepened that thinking a lot more. And I think at the same time, it's really just a really big challenge to kind of dare where Follett dared to go, namely leave academia and still be in academia in a way, to go into practice, but still be a scholar. And also be a scholar and still be a practitioner. And this kind of integration of all these different roles, I think it's to me still the big challenge that I see every time I read Follett. And if anything, I'm just more determined to kind of follow in her footsteps, but also to find a way to do this in the 21st century. So thanks for sparking again that motivation.
Special thanks go to Anna Rielander-Eklund for graciously joining us in this episode.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.